what they did. They ate their dinner, and then after dinner was over, she said, "Hey, anybody want some pie?" The husband did just like he was supposed to. And he said, "No, I don't believe I'll have any pie. Preacher, won't you get you some?" And the preacher said, I really don't want any pie either. Well, then after that, the husband began to think, he didn't eat the pie. So there's still a piece of pie. And, I like apple pie. I mean, that flaky crust, and he could just taste it. And he thought, well, if the preacher's not going to eat it, it's going to go to waste. So he says, come to think of it, I believe I'll take that piece of pie. Preacher said, I'll have a piece too. It's not, some of you are thinking, you'll get that about bedtime tonight. But it's not easy having folks over sometime, is it? Is it easy to entertain? How about at your house? What do you do when somebody comes over? You have to start 6 weeks ahead of time cleaning to get ready for their coming. Okay? We talk sometimes about if you're in Panama, they like for you to just drop by. We want to know this time this year when you're going to come next year in the United States, isn't it? We don't want folks, Panama, they think if you just drop by out of the blue, that's the greatest compliment. If you drop by our house out of the blue, you may get shot at or we'll let the dog out of the garage. We want to know you're coming and we want time to get ready. It's not always easy entertaining, is it? Now, I want you to think about, I don't mean to start horror memories in your mind. I don't want to create some images that are going to cause you to go to bed tonight and have nightmares. But for those of you that are parents, do you remember when your kids got married? Do you remember? I see some heads shaking. I see some horrified looks. And you're not thinking about the fact they moved out of the house, are you? You're thinking about what it took to get that wedding ready. You're thinking about the loan that you had to take out down at the bank. You're thinking of all of those things that were involved. Oh, I've got to feed 4 million people. And how are we going to fit them in the fellowship hall? And are we going to have enough food? And is there going to be enough drink? And, is everything going to fall in place? Are we going to be able to get the flowers? Are we going to be able to get the singers here? Is the music going to work? Are you going to have somebody sing live? Are you going to play a tape for the bride's song? Who's going to be the preacher? And all this kind of, all of that stuff that goes into a wedding. As you're feeling those memories now, both positive and good and exciting and uplifting, and maybe at the same time terrifying as you're thinking about all of that, I want you to take all of those feelings and emotions. Anybody here that's ever been to a wedding, whether you were the bride or the groom, or whether you're the parent or the grandparent, or maybe you just went with a friend or a neighbor, I want you to take all of those feelings, thoughts, and emotions, and I want you to put them into your reading of the text of John chapter 2. We're looking at the miracles of Jesus, the miracles of the Master, and we're going to start, we did kind of an overview of miracles and their purpose and so forth, but now we're going to actually start looking at some of the miracles of Jesus. And as we do so, everything has to have a beginning. Anything that's going had to start somewhere. And so we're going to see the beginning of Christ's miracles, and we're going to look at John chapter 2. What I'd like to do is just initially read those first 11 verses of John chapter 2, then I'd like to look at the wedding, the wine, and the what. Okay, so let's start off. John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. Now on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 to 30 gallons each. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And so they filled them to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw out some of it now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it to him. And when the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when the people have drunk freely, then he serves the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. First of all, let's talk about the wedding and what's going on with it. This has been a very exciting week in Christ's life. Okay, you've had the announcement of John the Baptist as to who Jesus is. Remember, John the Baptist was told in chapter 1 to look for a sign to know who the Messiah was. And the sign he was told to look for was the Spirit descending on Jesus in the form of a dove. And when he saw that at the baptism of Jesus, he began to proclaim, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." And so in John chapter 1, we read about how John the Baptist saw Jesus, said, "This is the Lamb of God," and how two of his followers went and started spending time with Jesus. They went home with Jesus that day. And so you have, one of those is Andrew, he goes and gets his brother Peter. And then Andrew and Peter take Jesus to their hometown of Bethsaida, and there they get Philip. And then they go and get Philip's friend Nathanael. And so what has happened is now they have traveled some 60 miles north. They're at a place called Cana, which is actually the hometown of Nathanael. Okay, remember, the end of chapter 1, we've got Nathanael being called. And so now we're going to Nathanael's hometown for a feast. Remember, you're not far from Nazareth. It's only, we think, about 4 miles from Cana to Nazareth. So you've traveled about 60 miles. It'll take you about 20 miles a day, about 3 days, to get from where Jesus was down on the other side of Jordan, down in southern Judah or Judea, to get up to where he is in Cana. And you're about 4 miles away from Nazareth. So these guys are close to home. They're around the area of the Sea of Galilee. I think there's a good chance that Jesus and his family had some connections to the family getting married. Of course, they were invited to the feast, so there were obviously some connections. But I think there may well have been some family connections, because Mary, the mother of Jesus, seems to have an intimate knowledge of what's going on in the back room when they're making preparations. Okay? In other words, we may go to a feast, we may go to a wedding, and we go to the wedding reception, but most of us don't know what's going on back in the kitchen. If they run out of something, most of us don't know about it unless we go to the punch bowl and there's no more punch in there or something. We don't know what conversations take on in the back. But family members who are making their way in and out of the back, or maybe even are helping with the wedding, they would know these things. And so I think there's a really good chance that Jesus and Mary may have been related to this family. There are some very, obviously it seems there's some very personal connections here, because the family, Jesus is invited, Mary's invited, the followers of Jesus are invited. And so these are local folks at a feast for family and friends at a wedding. Now generally what they did in the first century is they had weddings for a virgin, a woman who has never been with a man and never been married before. They had those weddings on Wednesday. Those who were widows, those who had had a husband and the husband died and they were getting married, those weddings usually happened on Thursday, and then you had a week-long celebration. Okay, if you thought it was a lot what goes into a wedding here, where you've got, you know, all the setup starts on at least Thursday, and you have the rehearsal and the rehearsal dinner on Friday, and then you have the wedding on Saturday, and you have the reception after that, but then everybody goes home. I want you to picture a situation where for the next week there's going to be a feast, and the family is responsible for entertaining all of these people. It is a major social event. And one of the worst things you could do in the first century was to not be hospitable. And so it was a major thing to not provide for your guests, to not be hospitable to your guests. So when they ran out of drink, it was a big deal. It wasn't just the fact somebody was thirsty. It was just a cultural faux pas, something you just didn't do. And it wasn't right and it wasn't appropriate, at least as they saw it in their culture. It was viewed as you're not being hospitable. And so it was an embarrassing thing for the family. Now, I've titled tonight's lesson, "The Reluctant Miracle," because Jesus didn't go there with any intention of performing a miracle, from what I can see. He didn't make plans. In fact, you look at most of Jesus' miracles, he responds to the situation before him. He responds to the need before him. But when this situation arises, Mary becomes aware of the fact that they are out of the wine. And so Mary goes to Jesus. Now, we learn in verse 11, this is the beginning of his miracles. I know there are some apocryphal works that try to say that Jesus performed miracles when he was a kid and everything else, but we have absolutely no inspired, authentic, biblical evidence that he did that. Okay, and the statement that's made at the end of this miracle speaks otherwise. So in other words, Mary didn't have lots of prior occurrences to base her faith and wisdom on, but she was convinced that her son, Jesus, the Messiah, could do something about the problem. So So she goes to him and says, they're out of wine. And the response is interesting. He doesn't call her mother. He uses the word gune, the word woman. And it sounds very insensitive to us. If I had said to my mother, if I'd called my mother woman, it would have taken weeks to put my body parts back together after my dad got through with me. Okay, you just didn't do that. But before we take this as a term of disrespect, you know, again, remember that in John 19, in the same book, when John is describing the events on the cross, and you have this incredibly tender moment where Jesus is asking his cousin and the disciple John the Baptist, or not John the Baptist, John the Apostle, excuse me, to take care of his mother. And you remember that scene where he says, woman, behold thy son, son, behold thy mother. In other words, you treat him like he's your son from this day forward. You treat her like she's your mother from this day forward. He calls her woman there. And I think that's, you know, if there's ever a tender moment, then that is that tender moment. Now, I remember interesting one time listening to Dan Winkler talk about that passage. And he said, in his personal opinion, and it's just an opinion, that there on the cross, Jesus referred to her as woman and not as mother because of the emotional attachment to the word mother. It was just more than he could emotionally stand to stay in the moment. You think about that. Here you are dying on a cross. You're naked and beaten and dying in front of your mother. And I want you to think of how hard it would be to look at your mother and say, mama. And so he thinks that by calling her woman, it was a way of him being able to say it and get through it. I have no idea, but I do know that there's an intimacy and a love there between Jesus and Mary. And I see that in that moment when he provides for his mother. And I see a respect for her throughout his life. You can go all the way back to Luke chapter 2. Remember when he had been lost and his mother comes and says, you know, why have you done this to us? And he says, well, don't you know I must be about my father's business? And the text says after that, he went home and was subject to his parents. I mean, he was the one that was right. Okay, and it was one of those few situations where kids actually knew more than their parents in this particular story in Luke chapter 2. Yet he was subject to his parents. He respected her. He respected her authority, and he loved her. And the wording he uses here doesn't change that. I don't know why he uses that terminology. Some have put forth the thought that, remember what is happening. For 30 years, he has been the carpenter's son. For 30 years, he's been Mary's son. For 30 years, he's been building things as a carpenter would do, living in Nazareth, preparing for the moment that his ministry would go public. John chapter 1, it goes public. He's baptized. That's God's public proclamation of who he is. God says, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. He begins to get followers. We've got Peter and Andrew and James and John. Those guys are beginning to become followers of Jesus. Many of them are present on this day. And so some would see this as he's beginning to have a detachment from his role as a son. Now he is the Messiah, going forth to save the world, having begun his public proclamation. And in essence, what his mother is asking him to do is to use his divine power in this situation. Okay, and so he steps out of the role of a son with a mother and stands there as the appointed Messiah sent from God, saying to someone who is a creature created by God, we look in John chapter 1, verse 3 through 5, Christ helped to create the world. And that standing in that position, he says, you know, what does this have to do with me? He has a mission. And what you see in Jesus' life is he has a mission and he has a purpose. And he stays focused on that mission no matter what anybody else tries to do. Do you remember when we were in Mark and we were looking at Jesus, how in chapter 8, 9, and 10, Jesus kept trying to say to his apostles he was going to die. And in chapter 8, Peter rebuked him for saying he was going to die, and Jesus said what? And he's talking to one of his best friends. He says, get behind me, Satan. Okay, Peter's one of Jesus' dearest friends. He's with him basically everywhere he goes once his ministry starts. Even though he's a dear friend, when he's trying at that moment to interfere with what his mission is or to set a different timetable for what God's mission is, then he says, get behind me, Satan. And so, as we look at what's going on with Jesus, his mother, meaning well, is in essence wanting him to use his divine power to get this family out of a tight spot. And I think that's kind of behind the background of Jesus saying, what does this have to do with me? And he goes on to say, my hour is not at hand. Now that expression is all the way through the Gospel of John. And elsewhere in the Gospel of John, it's referring to his death and his resurrection, his death on the cross. His whole life is pointing to that. And it keeps saying, it's not the hour, it's not the time, etc. It seems strange to be said in this context, because the death on the cross is not something that's in the immediate and imminent future. But I think what he's basically saying is, it's not time for me to reveal my power as I move forward toward that appointed time when I'm going to die for the sins of the world. It's not time for me to display my power and glory just yet. Yet, even though he said that, Mary was confident that he would do it for her. I don't know when, where, how, or why she felt that way, but she obviously felt that way because she went to those servants and said, you just do what he says to do. And so it's interesting to me, you see an incredible faith in her in the ability of Jesus and who Jesus is. And you also see within her a confidence that Jesus would do what she asked him to do. She had confidence in the relationship that existed between them, that in spite of his response, she felt like he would do it. Now what Jesus does then is they are to take these water pitchers, and it talks about those water pitchers, these stone pots, six of them there. And these were going to weigh at least 20 pounds each. I think the New American Standard actually brings it over into English for us and talks about 20 to 30 gallons, excuse me, is what it would have been, 20 to 30 gallons. These, not counting the stone, just the contents, would have weighed about 150 pounds. That's just the liquid substance in these huge pitchers. And this is purification water. The daily things of life made a person ceremonially unclean. It's not necessarily a medical issue. It's a ceremonial issue as to spiritual purity. And so what you would do at a feast like this is the servants would pour water over the hands of those who were the guests. Now don't picture people pulling out their Dial soap and, you know, getting all their antibiotic and antibacterial soap on their hands. It's not about getting the dirt out from under your fingernails. It was a ceremonial, ritualistic, spiritual kind of cleansing thing that they went through. And so what would happen is they'd pour them over their hands. Well, you've got a big feast that's going on for a week. You need a lot of water. And so that's why you've got these huge stone jars full of water. And so these they filled with water, and it's interesting the text says they filled it to the brim with water. Now I think that's not accidental that they did that, and I don't think it's accidental that the text says that. I think the reason for that is so that no one will say, well, they added something to it. He says it is filled with liquid. There is no room for anything else in this jar. If something happens to the liquid in this jar, it won't be because somebody added something to it, because it is literally filled to the brim. And so Jesus directs them to start serving the people. And I can just imagine, just see the look on the servant's face as they're saying, you want us to give them water? They're expecting wine. You want us? Okay. And so they start taking out, and they just can't, they just know they're going to start handing this out to all of these guests, and then people are going to start complaining, this is water! You know, what happened to the wine? I thought you people were good hosts. What kind of feast is this? I'm going home. I'm out of here. But then people start sipping on it. Nobody complains. Nobody says anything. They keep right on drinking just like they've been all night. And I can just imagine the looks on the servants' faces. They know what's happened. They know what Jesus has done. They saw Jesus there. And it's just fascinating to try to put yourself in the story and wonder what they were thinking. But what happens in the story is they call him the head waiter in the New American Standard. You know, most of our weddings, a lot of those, you had somebody that was a coordinator, okay? And they had all kinds of responsibilities, okay? It may be everything, some folks may just be simply standing in the back and say, okay, you walk in now. Others, it may be, getting boutonnieres on people, make sure everybody gets here on time, or making sure pictures get taken. But they have responsibilities connected with the wedding. This governor of the wedding feast and a head waiter, whatever you want to call it, isn't exactly like our coordinator, but I would say that would be the closest thing to it. They had certain special responsibilities related to the feast. One of the things they often did is they were responsible for working out, they were the negotiator of the dowry. Okay, because you had to have a dowry paid when you took somebody's daughter and married her to your son. And so often this head waiter, governor, whatever you want to call him, he was the negotiator to kind of work out the purchase price, okay? You had to buy your wife. You had to work out a dowry for that, and so he played that role. So he's a very significant person in the process. And you know the story. He says, you know, usually you bring out the good stuff, and then after everybody's had all they want to drink, and they're just kind of sitting around talking and sipping a little bit, then you bring out stuff that's not quite as good. I want you to think about that. When you first sit down to eat, I mean, you're hungry, your taste buds are alive. Then after you've been eating a while, do you notice the subtleties of what you're eating? Okay, if you're at a ball game and you started out at the first and started getting out pizza and tearing into it, but by the time the fourth quarter comes along, you've been nibbling all through that ball game, are your taste buds as sensitive as they were when you started and you were hungry and you'd just been thinking about that pepperoni pizza or whatever it is you're eating? And that's what he's talking about here. The significance is that he says what Jesus produced from the water was better than the original, which was supposed to be the best of the best. Now, as we talk about the wine, a lot of folks, when they look at this passage, they see in this passage a justification for social drinking. And they say, look, you know, I can drink alcoholic beverages socially because Jesus even made it. Some things we need to realize. There are three types of alcoholic beverages. Let's rephrase that. There are three types of wines. First of all, if you wanted to describe Welch's grape juice, which doesn't have any alcohol in it, or if you wanted to describe wine, which was alcoholic in the first century, you used the same word. They didn't have separate words for the different types. They used the same one. If a little girl wanted to go up to her mom and say, I want some grape juice, she said wine. Or not. She used the same word. So we can't, from the word, determine if it's alcoholic or non-alcoholic. They had that which was fresh from the grape, which was non-alcoholic, okay? It's going to be fresh, and that's generally felt to be the best. Then you have a little stage in between where it's kind of a tangy substance, but it's all, you know, it'd be incredibly difficult to ever get drunk off of it. Not that you couldn't, but you'd have to be pretty waterlogged to get enough alcohol out of it. And then you have what is often called in the Bible strong drink. And the Bible's pretty clear in its saying that you avoid strong drink at all costs. And so what you find in the Bible is the first one is seen positively in the Bible. The last one is seen extremely negatively in the Bible. The middle stage really isn't described and talked about much. And so the question, another thing I need to know, and a lot of folks say, well, there's no way they could have had grape juice that didn't have alcohol in it because they didn't have any way of refrigerate and keep stuff. Wrong answer. Not only could they make alcohol without alcohol content, or make grape juice without alcohol content in it, but they, it seems from what we read, actually much preferred it. And they had ways, for example, of sealing the containers they put it in, processes they used in distilling it and putting it in containers and sealing those containers. They would often bury them in the ground, which kept them at cooler temperatures. And they had ways of making grape juice which would remain in an unfermented state for up to a year. Okay, so I want you, we need to erase all of those thoughts you've had in your mind that they couldn't make non-alcoholic stuff because they didn't have a refrigerator to put it in. That's simply not the case. But what I want us to see is did Jesus create something that could make people drunk? Now, I want you to look at the setting here. You've got a group of people that have been drinking all night. Jesus is a part of this feast. Okay, if these people are drinking and getting drunk, Jesus is right there with them. He's participating in it. And he ends up making what they're going to continue to drink. I think Peter, who was likely at this gathering, okay, isn't that what it says? You know, the disciples went with him. We know from chapter 1, Peter's already begun to follow him. I want you to look at what Peter says. In 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 3, Peter is describing the lifestyle that these Christians used to live. He says it's a lifestyle, as you look in verse 4, that they've left. And others marvel that you no longer live in that lifestyle. It's what you used to be, but it's what you're not supposed to be now. And look what he says in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 3. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In other words, he said drinking parties and drunkenness, and he uses two separate words. You've got being drunk, but then you've got the drinking party, those two separate words that are used there. And he says that was a part of your former life when you lived away from God. That's what you were supposed to have left. He said that's no longer to be a part of your walk with God. And then I want you to go back to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. And listen to what Peter says about Jesus. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. Could Peter put forth Jesus as the supreme example? Could Peter say that Jesus was without sin if he participated, not only participated in a drinking party, a feast in which people were in the process of getting drunk, but he actually provided the drink that got them drunk? If Jesus had done that, then he violated what Peter taught, and he did not fit the example that Peter described. And I think based on that, it makes it impossible that we try to read into the idea, the idea that it's okay for me to socially drink alcoholic beverages. Whatever he made either had no alcohol, or as was many the case in their world, it had such a low alcoholic content that it would have been almost impossible to have drunk enough of it for it to have affected the way you thought and acted. They highly diluted things. And you need to remember that in their world, this is pre-modern distillation, okay? They hadn't come up with Jack Daniels yet, okay? They didn't know how to make, you know, 90 proof and those kind of things, okay? That's a modern development. And so the level of alcohol in much of what they made was far below the things that are available to us. I think when we look at our world and the high alcohol content that are in most of our beverages, okay, especially in our whiskeys and things off the tap, and a lot of the things that are available out there, when we look at the added issue of a mechanized world, where we've got automobiles, where we've got things that, you know, that can run over people and destroy people. You know, in the first century, somebody got drunk, what'd they do? They fell off a donkey. Today, they get drunk, they get behind the wheel of an automobile and kill about 50 people. And what I'm trying to say is that we need to be real careful, because it's like comparing apples and oranges to compare their world to our world. And so if I want to go into this and try to look for some excuse to bring alcohol into my home, you know, you can do that, but I don't think the Bible justifies it. And I've seen too many lives destroyed. I've been to too many funerals. I've counseled too many broken homes where alcohol was involved. And I will never feel like it's appropriate for a Christian to bring alcohol into their life as a social drinking thing. Jesus says, you know them by their fruits. And when you look at the fruits of alcoholic drinks, it doesn't produce godliness. But the real thing is, what does all this mean to us? What do I need to get out of this story? I think there are a lot of lessons. I think as I look at this story, I'm reminded that the honor with which God holds marriage in. You know, many times you've been to a wedding and it says, you know, Jesus honored the state of marriage by attending a marriage. I think that's appropriate. Jesus honors the sanctity of marriage. He values marriage and home. And God honors and values marriage so much that, for example, in the writings of Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, he compares the relationship between God and his people to a marriage relationship. And so I want us to realize that marriage is a good and honorable thing, okay? I've talked to you about before, I think. I don't know if I have or not, but I remember when we were getting married. You know, everybody, when you say, I'm getting married, you know, they go into this dissertation about how horrible it's going to be. And every once in a while, somebody would say, why, it's great. It's the best thing I've ever done. And you just wanted to hug those people. Because I think marriage is wonderful. And it's honored and sanctioned by God. And I hope that we respect marriage, that we honor marriage the way Jesus did. I think we see that Jesus interacts with people, okay? That he's an everyday person. He goes to wedding receptions. He spends time with people. He goes to feasts. That he cares about people and he interacts with people. And what's interesting to me is that I think in this you see the respect that Jesus has for his mother. Okay, he's 30 years old, and he is the Messiah. He does not have to do this if he doesn't want to. Yet even though he says it's not time, it's really not my plan or God's plan at this moment, he has so much respect for his mother that he honors her request, and he does it anyway. I want to challenge all of us to think, is that how we respect our parents? I'm not saying that when you're grown up, you have to do everything your parents have asked you to do. The Bible said when I got married, there was a leaving and a cleaving that took place. There was a change in that relationship. But I'm never to stop respecting my mama. And I'm never to stop respecting my father. If the creator of the world honored the request of his mother, okay, in this physical world, then shouldn't I honor, respect my parents, whether I'm a young person still living at home or whether I'm an older person who has aging parents in need of my help? Jesus teaches me to love and respect and honor my parents. The biggest focus on this is on who Jesus is. Because notice in verse 11, the beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The significance of this event is that it is an unveiling of the power of Jesus. Throughout the Gospel of John, John uses the word sign to describe a miracle. Remember we talked about those three words for miracles: signs, miracles, and wonders. Sign was John's favorite word. He picked out seven from his period before the cross, one after the cross. And what John is trying to say is that every single one of these are pointing me to faith in Jesus. And so what I have in John chapter 2 is an unveiling of the power and the glory and the majesty of Jesus. This Jesus who turned the water to wine, who cared enough about a family's embarrassment. I mean, nobody's going to die here. Yet he cared enough about the embarrassment and the situation the family was in that he was willing to alter maybe what he had originally planned to do out of respect for his mother, out of respect and love for those people. And in the process, he unveiled his greatness. And I hope in the process, what happened to them will happen to us. Because did you notice in verse 11, it says, "And his disciples believed." Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? I find it interesting that Jesus was invited. Wouldn't it be neat if you're making your guest list for your child's wedding, if you could say, you know, I'd like the apostles to come? I think it would be neat. Of course, my kids aren't going to get married. They can't date till they're 25. But eventually, maybe someday, a perfect person comes along and wants to marry one of them. Wouldn't it be neat to be able to send a note over to Jesus' house and say, "Jesus, would you come to my child's wedding? Or could you get Peter and John and the guys together and y'all just come?" Wouldn't it be incredible? Makes me think about how incredible heaven's going to be. But I want us to think about something. You know, we need to invite Jesus to our wedding. We need to invite him into the lives of our children. We need to invite him into our lives. And that's what I'd like us to think about as we get ready to sing this invitation song. Have I invited Jesus over? Is Jesus welcome in my marriage? Is Jesus welcome where I work? Is Jesus welcome in the lives of my children and where my kids go to school? Have we invited him in? Have we made him welcome? Have we made him a part of the family? I don't know who these people are in Cana of Galilee, but they wanted Jesus to be there. As we sing this invitation song, do we want Jesus to be in our life? Because when you invite Jesus over, incredible things happen. If you'd like to find out how to become a Christian and how to invite Jesus into your life, or if you'd like prayer and encouragement to let him have the place he once had in your life if you're a child of God and you've forgotten to keep Jesus in your life, then won't you come right now and let's talk about it as we stand and sing.